The story of how disabled U.S. veterans have been treated by the government and society is long and complicated, at times touching but also shocking. This is Florida Matters.
Support for Florida Matters comes from the Hospitals of BayCare Health System, providing more than 100 health seminars, classes, and events each month. BayCare's mission is to build a healthier Tampa Bay. Register for a complimentary health seminar, class, or event at baycareevents.org.
On location from the Samuel Bell Auditorium at USF Tampa, I'm Carson Cooper. Emmy Award-winning filmmaker Rick Burns tells the story of injured veterans in the U.S. in a new documentary called Debt of Honor, Disabled Veterans in American History. It will air on WUSF-TV Sunday, November 22nd. During the second half of our program, we'll take questions from our audience here, so let's get right to it. Let's welcome our guest. This Emmy Award-winning director brought us such films as Death in the Civil War, Ansel Adams, and the hauntingly beautiful New York Center of the World. He was a writer and co-producer of his brother Ken Burns' masterwork, The Civil War. Please welcome Rick Burns.
Thank you so much, Carson.
Army Private J.R. Martinez retired, was deployed to the Middle East in 2003 and suffered severe burns from an IED in Iraq. He is a national spokesperson for Operation Finally Home. He's also an actor. You may have seen him on All My Children, Dancing with the Stars, the Grand Marshal of the 2012 Rose Parade, and the current action series SAF3. J.R. Martinez, welcome to Florida Matters.
Thank you.
And thank you for your service.
Thank you.
Rick Burns, why did you make this film?
You know, the most direct reason was a remarkable woman from South Florida named Lois Pope came to my colleagues and me about 3 years ago. Lois has basically dedicated her philanthropic life since young adulthood to the cause of disabled veterans. And she said, would you make a film about the history of disabled vets? And, you know, I'm a ex-hippie, kind of from Ann Arbor, Michigan, a child of the 60s and 70s. And so I'm very much part of a generation that separated from the American military, that sort of found some way to clump people who were serving in with policies that we might have opposed. And therefore, you know, I was 18 in 1973, and that was the last year we had a draft. I had a number, but I had no chance of ever being called up. And so I'm very much part of the – I'm a sort of an honorary member of the 99%, the civilian – 99% of Americans who are civilians who are never going to have to be in the war and never going to have to see military conflict, as opposed to the 1% who serve, like JR. And I think that when Lois – came to us and said that, I was very, very struck, first of all, by the fact that, I don't want to say hiding in plain sight, but a very, very large aspect of the American experience is summarized by the experience of disabled veterans, and it's something that most of us know nothing about. Mm-hmm. And they are the most vivid reminder of what it costs to fight, what the sacrifices are that are made. And I think that particularly since we separated from our military during and after the Vietnam War, we have become so remote from that. The people, it's almost as if we live in two countries. You know, there are places like where we are tonight, Tampa or San Antonio or San Diego or Newport News or Oklahoma, where there is no real gap between the civilian and military cultures. They're combined. They live together and the families intermingled. In most places in the country, that's not the case. I live on the Upper West Side of Manhattan, and there's not a big commingling of civilian and military culture, and that's wrong. We have really lost touch. The 99% have lost touch dramatically with the experience of those who serve. And in the process, we've also lost touch dramatically with what it means to serve something larger.
Private Martinez, how old were you when you went into the military?
I was 19.
Were you, Rick Burns says, in touch prior to getting into the military? What was your attitude like before you were actually in the military?
I was not in touch. I was one of those individuals that was essentially naive. I was not one of those individuals that who have served in these current conflicts that talk about how their father served or their grandfather served, and so they were essentially carrying on a tradition. I did not have that. My family immigrated to this country from Central America, so I was the first in my family to, one, be born in this country and then to essentially graduate from high school and then join the United States military. So I always tell a lot of individuals that when I raise my right hand, like so many men and women, to serve this country, I understood that war was a possibility, but I never really truly understood what that necessarily meant. Mm-hmm. And I never really thought that it would actually be a reality. I was very naive towards it.
Yeah, some folks might be reticent to speak with or interact with a disabled veteran simply because they don't know what to say. I think a lot of people might be afraid of upsetting them somehow by saying the wrong thing. Do you think that's a big problem when it comes to the divide between the military and society?
Absolutely. I think we have, as human beings, we have a tendency to overthink everything. As a young 19, 20, 21, 22, even now being 32 years old, what still upsets me to this day is when people just stare at me. Mm-hmm. And they're not children. I get children. I understand children. I give essentially the pass to, and I don't say anything to. I don't look at them in a certain way. But adults do it, and they just stare. And what I would appreciate, and a lot of my friends, I'm speaking on behalf of a lot of my friends who are physically disabled, they would appreciate if someone just came up and said, hey, what happened to you? That's it. Simple. What happened? And it creates this dialogue, and it starts this dialogue, and that's what we have as a society. We have to start thinking about is essentially just having an open dialogue instead of overthinking it. And then what you do is it ultimately pushes you to not have a conversation at all. Instead, engage in that conversation simply by treating that individual as a human being. Just because they may use a cane, just because they may have a prosthetic, just because they may have burns on their body at some point, whatever the severity of the injury may be physically, we just have to at least at the end of the day look at them as a human being, as a son, as a daughter, as a father, as a mother, brother, sister, friend, whatever it may be.
Debt of Honor takes us through the Revolutionary War, Civil War, on through the more recent wars, Korea, Vietnam, and so. Why did you take this historical approach to telling the story?
You know, I think there's some really basic existential facts of life that we tend not to think of as having histories. We think of death as not having a history, but there's a history to death. People have died in different ways at different times and different numbers. And there's also a history to being disabled in war. And we tend to think, well, you know, a burn is a burn is a burn. Or, you know, an arm that's lost is, you know, today is the same as an arm that was lost 200 years ago. That's simply not the case.
Is that a family model that you guys say?
A burn, yeah, burns
is, a burn,
is, a burn,
is a burn is a burn is a burn. That's what we are as a family. Is a burn is a burn is a burn is a burn. at the dinner table,
it's
that's
subliminal
what's
advertising. We try to get the word in as much as we can. I appreciate that. But, you know,
yeah, you got
we
two
really
burns
don't
up
have,
here.
As David Gerber said in the film, a wonderful historian of disability at SUNY Buffalo. You know, you don't really have disabled veterans as a group in any large number until the Civil War. We think of the Civil War as a time of mass casualties, which it was. It was the time of the beginning of the dawn of medical science, where we really began to save people in enough numbers that you could say, well, there's going to be a population of people who are going to come home having been grievously wounded, but they didn't die. See, it's not. Medicine has to get to a certain point in order to ensure that you have a meaningfully large population of disabled veterans, and that increase is the story of the last 150 years, war by war. We've just increased our ability to save lives, to put back together people who have been really grievously harmed, to the point where, as in the Revolutionary War, 1 in 2 died. Now it's 1 in 10 died.
That's a good point you bring up, too, because we certainly didn't have as many disabled veterans in those past wars, but we had veterans, and notably World War II, veterans came home to a country that was celebrating victory, and we celebrated our veterans with big parades, not to mention that great, nice post-war economy and the GI Bill and all that. Many wars since then didn't exactly have our troops coming home to the spoils of victory. Do you believe that because Americans aren't celebrating the ends of wars, we're simply not celebrating veterans and they're suffering the consequences?
We've had a couple of very complicated wars. I mean, Korea was the forgotten war. We kind of started it and then lost the will really to continue it in a certain way, and it sort of began to slip under the radar. Vietnam was almost the opposite. Vietnam became the first war where so many people, by no means all Americans, separated from the policy behind the war. And so it became, hell no, we won't go. And, you know, at that point, there was a profound turning against by a certain sector of the population against the military, as if the men who were fighting were the same thing as the policy you were opposing. That was really an enormous nadir in American experience. That's the point where, you know, one thing we were already heading towards was an increasingly small army compared to the size of the civilian population, was sort of coupled with this very strange thing where somehow we were repudiating what the men, and now men and women, were doing by being in the military. You know, that's not the case, fortunately, today, but it took me a good portion of my adult life coming out of, you know, the Midwest in the 70s and 80s to realize that that moment of the Vietnam War period, sure, oppose the war if you're opposed to the war, but don't oppose the men who are fighting it. Don't spit on them when they get off the troops demobilizing from Vietnam. We're not in that position today. I think that, you know, we're now in a position where, thank God, as I think has been the case throughout most of American history, Americans, whether they oppose or not a particular war or a policy, absolutely support the men and women. But we're still far too divided from our troops, and we have drifted too far apart. We need to reintegrate, and if we don't, we're really losing our way, I think, morally as a country.
Private Martinez, you sort of touched on this just a moment ago, that disabled veterans can sort of be a, well, actually not sort of, can be a vivid reminder of the horrors of war. Do you think society as a whole ignores veterans because they don't want to be reminded of war?
I think there's some truth to that. First, let me start by saying you keep calling me Private Martinez. You're reminding me of me being in the military at 19 and being smoked by my platoon sergeants. You say it in the same tone.
I'm not going to give you any orders.
I have post-traumatic stress disorder from your voice right now. Just
okay.
I'm going to drop and give you 10. That's all I can give you right now.
Give me 20 for that.
No, okay. I can give you 10. I'll give you the
JR.
10 next week.
All right, JR.
I feel old, man. I'm beaten up at 32. But I think there is some truth to it. I think, you know, as Rick touched on, you know, as a society, you know, we have a tendency. It's been 12 years, and I was one of the first injured in Iraq, and so I've kind of, to some extent, have had an opportunity to really kind of see the transition with the interactions that I've had with people over the last 12 years, and I will say that. I think what has been very strong at very early on, people were just all about our men and women, all about it, because it was recent, it was new, it was in your face, it was televised, it was publicized. You know, the war, the conflicts, what was happening. You saw images of these individuals coming back, you know, with their bodies completely changed and different. And I think what happens is people just, you know, we live in a society where it's a very short attention span. And so needless to say, like, you know, anything past 30 seconds, you know, we've tuned out now as Americans, and we're back to our daily grinds. We're back to our daily agendas. We're back to essentially doing what we need to do for our own personal lives and our families. And unless you have a direct connection to the military, no one's really going to be reminded of it unless you attend an event like this, unless you listen to this radio show, or unless you happen to be flipping through the channels and you see this documentary, then you're saying, oh, there it is. Okay, this is still happening. I've had people over the last few years actually say to me, we still are there in Iraq and Afghanistan. We still have troops over there. This is still happening.
Yeah.
I thought the president said the war was over. Well, that's a misconception. No different than it's a misconception that is, when veterans come home, that the government essentially takes care of everything. And that's what a lot of people have a tendency to believe, is that the government does everything. And they do their best, but yet there's a lot of gaps and there's a lot of holes. And I think that's where you need individuals like Rick. I think that's where you need individuals like Lois Pope, who cares about this and has the ability and the voice to ultimately reach out to the right people that she has in her Rolodex to essentially care about this and be interested again. But that's where you need veterans as well. That's where you need veterans. It falls on me. It falls on the 2.7 that have served in Iraq and Afghanistan to ultimately be a voice and speak up. Now, listen, I don't know how many people we have in here. What would you guess? 40, 50 people. I don't know. Maybe 30. I don't know. I'm not good with that. But needless to say, you know, if I asked everybody right now, if you're a veteran, raise your hand. Okay, so I'm going to count. Please keep your hand up. Joel, you asleep? Raise your hand. We 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. We have 9 people that raised their hand that they're veterans. Now, well, I'm 10. So out of those 10 people, you have 2 that are physically wounded that at least we all can see in this room. That's Joel and that's myself. The rest of those individuals that are veterans, they look like everybody else walking down the street. They look like everybody else on the Upper West Side in Rick's neighborhood. Yet, I'm sorry to be telling everybody
please,
where you live.
Please.
I mean, if you want to give us cross streets to really narrow it down, you know, 110th. Okay, yeah. Got it. But that's what I'm saying is that we as a society, we have to understand that not all veterans look like, you know, those that have amputees or are blind or have burns or have traumatic brain injuries. A lot of them have those emotional scars, have those mental scars, and they walk amongst every single one of us. Mm-hmm. I mean, you see, you know, this is not a knock on anything, you know, but this is essentially, you know, you see the NFL. I love football. And you watch the NFL in the month of October, you see purple all over the field. Pink all over the field. You see pink everywhere, and it's for breast cancer. And it's great. Why is everyone so behind breast cancer and not essentially like in the month of November when you have Veterans Day, no one's wearing camo. No one's essentially really doing a salute to service. It's not a full month thing. Well, because breast cancer is something that affects everybody. Everybody knows someone to some extent that's affected by cancer.
Rick Burns, what do you think of this? Speaking of the military and speaking of wearing camo, it's anecdotal, but there are schools around the nation that tell kids to take off their shirts because they have maybe a POW message on it, something that honors their father or mother who's serving in the military. Seems like the military in some schools is simply forbidden on a school campus.
And there, you know, we have decades and decades of having become estranged from military experience and having become estranged from that smaller and smaller sector of our population that serves. And I think that, you know, to get back to what JR was saying earlier, you know, that thing where, you know, every disabled veteran knows the look in the supermarket where somebody, it's a look first of horror and then it's the guilty look away. I can't take my eyes off it, but now I feel ashamed, I'm going to look away. And, you know, that is something that is so deeply inculcated in our culture now that we need to really, really fight against it so that we do what JR is describing, where we understand that, you know, you can high-five somebody with a stump. You can treat somebody, no matter what, as somebody who could be just, you could be your brother, your sister, your mother, your father. In other words, I think what we have to do is that if somebody has decided that they're going to make the sacrifice to serve and perhaps leave part of themselves on a foreign battlefield, we have to understand that they have earned the right to be considered something like our mothers, fathers, brothers, sisters, their family to us. And that if my brother came home, burned over 34% of his body, or with, you know, as a double amputee, his new normal would become my new normal. Of course it would. But that should be the way each and every American citizen in civilian society treats the men and women when they come back. It should be something that we do not in any way undersell. We don't want to say this isn't a grievous wound, this isn't an enormous challenge, but we accept what they've decided to accept as a normal risk. They took the risk, they're suffering, they're dealing with the consequences. We have, at the very least, we need to say, we're going to be there with you and reach across that divide.
One thing I thought was so stunning about Debt of Honor from what I've seen is that it shines a light on the fact that over the years, battlefield medicine has caught up, has improved, but battlefield psychiatry has not. Hard to believe that no mental health counseling in the Vietnam War.
Oh, isn't it amazing?
Just stunning.
Yeah. Yeah, Max Cleland, three limbs blown off on April 8th, 1968, and he comes back and he gets to Walter Reed, and there's no psychological counseling. There's no psychological counseling at the VA. You know, the Vietnam War more or less coincided with the dawn of modern neurology. You know, psychiatry and psychology maybe have a little bit of an earlier beginning at the end of the 19th, early 20th century. But that point where we began to really understand, when somebody was shell-shocked or had, you know, were suffering from the commotional or concussive effects of artillery shelling in World War I, we knew something was going on, but we didn't have any way of looking inside them and understanding the severe damage being done to their brain, to their nervous system. Well, it was not until the late 50s, early 60s that the very beginning of that came online. And that's when we began to understand a little bit more and a little bit more about what was going on with TBI or PTSD.
Debt of Honor, Disabled Veterans in American History will air Sunday, November 22nd on WUSF-TV. Back with our guests and questions from our studio audience. In just a moment, I'm Carson Cooper. This is Florida Matters. Emmy Award-winning filmmaker Rick Burns tells the story of injured veterans in the U.S. in a new documentary called Debt of Honor, Disabled Veterans in American History. It will air on WUSF-TV on November 22nd. Our guests are Army Private Retired J.R. Martinez and the director of Debt of Honor, Rick Burns. As promised, questions from our audience now. So if you would please tell us your name and where you're from and, well, who's first?
Hello, my name is Elder Williams. I go by Tony. I'm the president of Veterans Council of Veterans. First of all, do you feel a showing of this movie will have a less appeal because it's about disabled veterans, and it may actually discourage the family members and the young generation from actually joining the military in the future? So do you feel this may have a dampening effect as far as recruiting?
Rick Burns, what about that first point? Do you think your movie might discourage people from a military career?
You know, a reporter said to me something really, really insightful the other day about our film. She said, I thought it was really enlightening, I thought it was really harrowing, and I thought it was really hopeful. You know, I think that if the effect of a film like this, and there are many films like this, were to make more real and vivid the cost of war, and that made anybody think twice about anything that moved towards belligerence, I'm for that. I'm not going to say that's a bad thing. But at the same time, it's really simply showing what the consequence is of military commitment. It's not saying military commitment is wrong. And on the other hand, I think what it is showing is it's showing the astonishing nature of men and women who are willing to serve something larger. And I can tell you, for all the people, the thing that the 99% is not getting, we want what that 1% is getting. We want that connection to something larger that comes when you serve something larger. And we have been adrift, morally and existentially adrift, in too much of the population because we do not have that instinct. We have not had it demanded of us that we think of something larger than our own lives. I think that for me, the impact of listening to JR, or listening to Max Cleland, or listening to Tammy Duckworth, the people in our film, or Greg Gadson, is I find them role models. I would like to follow them where they've gone, not necessarily in the military, but maybe in the military. So I think that it may make it more harrowing by making it more real, but I think it also ennobles anybody who sees it, because you see, this is really what it meant. It was not a cartoon. This is not a video game. This is not a video game.
Mm-hmm.
This is what really happens, and you do not want to separate anybody from the truth of that consequence. And at the same time, to be ennobled and lifted up by the example of service to something larger is a huge asset. And my experience is, you know, you want to move closer to people like J.R. or Tammy Duckworth or J.R. or Greg Gadson or Max Cleland, the wounded vets we interview in our film. They're people who really show you something really profound about what commitment is and what moral responsibility is in a way that's uplifting. And I believe that if there was a message in our film that's not declared but is in every frame of this film, it is that if this country were to return to something like universal mandatory conscription, not necessarily into the military, but if every 18 to 24-year-old young man and woman in this country had to give 2 years of his or her life doing something either on the civilian side or on the military side they choose, but where they had to give Urban Corps, you know, Conservation Corps, Teach for America, or the Armed Services as they chose, what you'd discover is that they would be scaling for themselves what the nature of the kind of commitment people like JR make all the time. And then you would discover almost magically that the divide between the military and the civilian would simply disappear.
JR, did somebody try to talk you out of joining the military? Did your mama say, JR, come on, what are you doing?
I walked into the house and she was in the kitchen and I actually ran into the kitchen. I was like, Mom, I figured it out. I know exactly what I'm going to do with my life. And she's like, what is it, mijo? I was like, I'm going to join the United States Army. No, you're not. It like immediately shot me down because my mother, being from El Salvador in the early 80s, there was a war that was happening there. She understood what war was about. She had lost a daughter due to an illness that she was born with. We were already at war in Afghanistan. There was a possibility of Iraq. So my mother understood, you know, that if her only son, youngest child, goes to war, that there's a possibility of her losing another child. So that's what made up her answer. But at the end of the day, like it was an entire package for me. Mm-hmm. It was not just this is only it. And you know, to Tony's question, you know, and just to kind of an extension of Rick, I get a lot of people that come up to me when I travel. And it'll say to me, my son, my daughter, my niece, my nephew, somebody in my family is thinking of going. Tell them not to. Tell them no. Tell them don't do it. And it's like they want me just to show up at their door, you know, and just be like, look at me. Don't do it. You know, and then run away. You know, it's like I'm not going to do that, you know, because as much as I'm here and I am one of the realities of war, people also have to understand that not every single person that joins the military is affected in this same capacity. Not everybody. I mean, yes, there's staggering numbers of how many men and women that are actually affected physically, but then those that are affected mentally and emotionally, but that's not everybody. I mean, it's not. So, and I think that I remember what I got out of the military is more than I think I could have gotten in the civilian sector if I would have just done what my mom wanted me to do, was go to community college and just sit there and work and essentially live in her house because we're Hispanic and I was going to live there till I was 47. That's
no dancing with the stars there.
So exactly, there would be no dancing with the stars. I'd be dancing with my mom. I mean, it'd be I still would have 15 years of essentially of a sentence that I would have to carry out at this point in my life.
Next question.
First of all, thank you for your service, and thank to the service of all the veterans that are here present.
Thank you.
Second, thank you for a powerful production that's going to serve as a good wake-up call to our reality that we're living. I present not a question. I just want to bring a comment that I am a local prosthetist. I make prosthetics for a living. Mm-hmm. And I've done this for 35 years. And the catalyst of prosthetic developments, unfortunately, have been these wars and have been the veterans that have come back turned up. And we have been able to develop microprocessor knees, articulating electronic hands, thanks to you guys, that now serves all the community and all the society.
You know, that's so true of every ER room in this country is a direct beneficiary of what's happening in the military and the battlefield hospitals. I mean, that's where we have learned to become at the cutting edge of putting people back together. And so far outside the precincts of the military experience, that military prowess is felt every day by every kid who goes in, breaks their arm on a skateboard, and discovers some extraordinarily competent man or woman who's in the ER room and puts them back together again. They learned how to do that because of things that were learned as JR was being evacuated from the front line. I mean, that's where we learned that. That's the laboratory.
And I've met a lot of people, my travels across the country, that were physicians, were doctors, were medics on the front lines in combat, and they've now retired from the military and they've gone into the private sector, and they're helping save lives based on the experience that they had, based on, you know, patching me up, patching all these other service members up on the battlefield.
J.R. Martinez, thank you so much for your service to our country. We are truly in debt. Emmy Award-winning director Rick Burns, whose documentary Debt of Honor, Disabled Veterans in American History, will air Sunday, November 22nd on WUSF-TV. Rick Burns, it's been an honor and a pleasure to meet you. Thank you so much, Carson. Our show is produced by Lottie Watts, remote engineer Mark Hayes. Florida Matters is a production of WUSF Public Media. I'm Carson Cooper. Thanks for listening.